You're listening to the Embrace Family Recovery Podcast, a place for real conversations with people who love someone with the disease of addiction. Now here is your host, Margaret Swift Thompson.
Welcome back. Today, I'm sharing the final part of Georgia Jameson's story with you. In today's episode, we discuss the roots of Georgia's addiction, how her addiction changed over the years, and the fears she's experienced as a professional in the field. Let's rejoin Georgia.
The Embrace Family Recovery Podcast.
I loved your description of the three jobs as a counselor. I wrote them down because I thought they were so simplistic, but so profound and so wonderful. And I find it important to share this because a lot of people seeking help don't know to interview, to ask questions, to get the right fit. So you wrote, see them, accept them, and partner with them, walk alongside them to reach their goal. That's beautiful and so on point. Do you feel that that was always an awareness you had in your teaching? Has that been changed by your own journey of therapy and recovery?
I think it is. Talk about another paradox of recovery. I could see so well what other people needed to recover, but couldn't do it myself. So the see people, see, you know, sort of all parts of them, see the parts they can't see, see the parts that they keep hidden. All of it, see the whole person and then accept them. And by accept them, you have to let go as a therapist of any desire that they be any different. You can't think that they need to be, they should be doing this, or if only they did that, like all of that. You have to just completely let go and completely accept. This is exactly who they are, doing exactly what they need to be doing right now. And that they are on their own journey, and that who the hell am I to think I know what they need, and that I know, you know, more than this person who's living their life. Okay. And then once you get there, that opens the gate that you can truly join them and say, hey, where do you want to go? How, you know, like I can use my tools and my skills to help you get there. This is terrain that I'm pretty familiar with. I know all the trails, I know all the shortcuts, all that sort of stuff. But you have to set the goal of you know, where's the destination.
If I was not at the beginning of that conversation, that little piece that we just did, and I closed my eyes, wouldn't that be something for all parents of people with the disease of addiction to hear and internalize too? All partners, all children, all family members. If we could learn those three things in recovery as family and affected loved ones through our own recovery, we would be 10 steps ahead of where we are today.
I have to do this every single semester with students. Some student comes in and one of their clients has had a return to use and they think they failed, that they've done something wrong, or that, you know, to not only let them know that that's not happening, but that this person might have needed that return to use as part of their recovery, and that we shouldn't keep them from that if that's what they needed. If there was something they were going to learn by that particular use episode that was going to support and shore up lifelong recovery, maybe they needed that. Mm-hmm. But to truly accept the limitations of, you know, sort of my role and who I am and what I can and can't do.
And families the same.
Exactly.
It's a lot of parallels, which is really helpful. I knew there would be when I was reading your book and just thinking about having this conversation. You willing to talk about Beulah?
Sure.
Because that really touched me, and I would love you to share what you want to about Beulah. Am I saying the name right? Beulah?
Beulah. Beulah actually was the first chapter I wrote in the whole book. That was the story that the second I sat down and opened a Word document, that was the first thing that I laid down, because it was so powerful for me. And the story of Beulah, when I was, in my food addiction, I wanted to personify my ugly fat belly. And so I just thought, what is the most disgusting, ugliest name in the world? And it was Beulah, like Beulah. And so, my ugly body, my ugly need for food, all of it became about Beulah. Beulah wants this, Beulah needs that, or stupid Beulah, all this sort of just this sort of stuff. And in the course of all the work that I did with Jenny, she helped me understand that a big part of recovery was about stopping the seeking of love and approval and affection from everyone else and starting to supply it to yourself. And I, really took that message to heart. And so I was like, what's the mantra out of that? And it was bring your own love, acceptance, and approval. Bring your own love, acceptance, and approval. And then I was just like, what's the acronym there? What does that stand for? Bring your own love, acceptance, and approval. B-Y-O-L-A-A. What would that sound like if we strung those letters together? Beulah. And it was just Beulah. Beulah is, that's what addiction and recovery is. So Beulah went from this, monster who had control of me to just this, curious little sensitive kid who just wanted me to take care of her.
Really resonate with that. And I think it's so empowering and beautiful and spiritual that you were able to come up with that and change that. The feed me visual of that show. I can't even think of the name of it. What is the show where the plan is always yelling, feed me?
Oh, Seymour. Yeah.
That's what I visually get when you, and just to see how you were able to reframe that for your ongoing recovery. And I assume, and I shouldn't, so I'm going to ask, that Beulah shows up in different forms still.
Which one?
The first one.
The sort of hardcore, feed me Beulah.
Fire in.
It is sometimes, but it's also, I do have to remember, it's so easy for me to flip into my bring your own Beulah. I just really am sort of like, what if you were kind to yourself here instead of judgmental? What if you were, all of these things? What would that look like instead? I mean, it's the curse and the blessing of being a therapist. We know all the things to say to other people. And when we're ready to hear them, we have the tools to use, and that sort of kind of a thing.
Yeah. Well, I have lots of thoughts, but I want to just make sure we touch on a few other things that really struck me. And I don't want to share about everything in the book because I want people to read it. Where are you at, by the way, with publishing and getting it out there so people can read it?
So I'm currently looking for a publisher. I've sent out to my last publisher that I'm going to solicit. And if nothing comes out of this, then I'll go into the self-publishing route. It'll find a way kind of through. But boy, have I learned in the past couple of years, like what a world publishing is and, just how insane and crazy it is to get something out there. And also how many different paths there are to really do it.
Right. I've met quite a few authors in doing the podcast who have self-published because they just felt it was important to get it out and they tried the roots. Please keep me posted so I can let everybody know when it is available because I know people will be eager to read your book, Georgia.
This podcast is made possible by listeners like you.
Anyone enjoy book clubs? I do for a few reasons. I read books that I would not normally choose to read. And I really value listening to other people who've read books share their experience with what they learned, read, and heard. So in that vein, I'm beginning the Embrace Family Recovery Free Virtual Book Club starting Thursday, April 18th at noon Eastern Standard Time for anyone who wants to join. Oh, yeah. What's the book? The book is Worthy, by Jamie Kern Lima. I chose this after learning more about Jamie's story, feeling a connection with her, and wanting to eradicate the core belief and story in my head that has always said, I'm not enough. This book club is for anyone, and I welcome anyone who wants to dive into the lies that we have let stop us from believing we are worthy. Check out my show notes for links to my website, embracefamilyrecovery.com, to learn more and register. Also, really cool, I have happened to come across an extra copy of the book Worthy, which is really hard to find right now as they're selling out. So I will send to the 10th person who registers for this book club their free copy of Worthy. Can't wait to see you on April 18th. Let's get ready to do a deep dive into the book Worthy on a monthly basis.
You're listening to the Embrace Family Recovery Podcast. Can you relate to what you're hearing? Never miss a show by hitting the subscribe button. Now back to the show.
Can we talk about gastric bypass a little bit?
Yes.
Because it's one of the ones that a lot of us in food addiction have navigated our own journeys, looking for an answer, an offer being given, thinking it's going to be a solution, and then the confounding of the shame when that is eaten through or over, and the struggle to then continue to believe there is a solution that can work. How has your journey around that been? What's your understanding of cross addiction and physiological differences with gastric bypass and other addictions?
Well, no, it's interesting. And my views of this really are starting to shift in the past few months, that for a very long time, I wrapped myself around the idea that gastric bypass saved my life.
Okay.
That if I had to live any longer in that big a body, that I would not have continued to live. I would have killed myself or something would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so that having the surgery, even with everything that happened from it, that it was overall good because it saved my life.
Okay.
And what I'm really grappling with these days, and it's still new in its infancy, but the truth is, when I got the gastric bypass surgery, which, by the way, I lied my way through every assessment process to show them that it wasn't food addiction that I had, because it's one of the rule outs for gastric bypass. If it's food addiction, you can't get the bypass. And I lied and manipulated every assessment and everything. And then again, because I had the badge of I'm an addiction psychologist, they were like, oh, well, she must know. So this must be true. And so we, let her get the surgery. But it was having the gastric bypass that as soon as my ability to overeat dropped off, because I physically couldn't.
Yeah.
My addiction to pills took off.
Yeah.
Just like it was, blast off into space. And so the gastric bypass actually sent me into the worst of my substance use disorder. And that's a very different way of looking at it as having saved my life. So it's still new. I'm still kind of figuring out and kind of working through it. But again, back in that, if I'm going to accept other people, I have to accept myself as well. Maybe that was part of my journey. Maybe getting the gastric bypass, maybe having the springboard into substance use disorder, maybe all of that was necessary in my journey to get to where I am now.
I believe that. I also wonder if you won't do something academically with the wonderful brilliance and knowledge you have mixed with your experience to help us in the field see that correlation of you having the bath, because I've been saying this for a long time, working with clients who have the bypass, then their substance use skyrockets. They get into a rehab center, they're putting down the substances and the food intake skyrockets to the point that they're having so many complications, dumping, physical ailments, secrecy, the whole nine yards. And so for me, there's this bias and this hope that you and your intellectual capacity and your ability to say things in such a great way and to teach the future generations of the helpers in this field, who knows where that might take you.
Yeah. And then it is really great if you stop looking at addiction as a substance and start looking at it as a process. The process could use any substance.
Right.
And that if we started teaching our clients and started teaching family members that what addiction really is it's poor problem solving. We are trying to deal with a problem. We have a need, we have something that's going on, and we're trying to cope. And our brains have this weird, wonky way of thinking this is going to help us. And whether it's food or pills or alcohol or sex or, you know, anything, money, achievement, all of these things, that it really is about understanding that process. Mm-hmm. And that true recovery means interrupting that process and learning a whole different way of being in the world.
As we say in the rooms, you don't have to change much, just about everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Kindergarten or earlier was when you realized there was a solution in a pill.
Yes.
And that process then continued through pills and food.
Yeah. When I tell my story, I always start out the same way. I don't know the exact moment I became an addict, but I know it happened by the time I was 5 years old.
Again, evidence that it is an illness and that mm-hmm. it is something in the brain that has impacted the continuation of your survival skills and what you used. Mm-hmm. So when people want to blame, shame, judge, you know, one of my previous supervisors would say, who has an audition for the part of addiction? I don't know many people. Mm-hmm. Those who don't have it are spared having it, though I think every one of the human race could benefit from recovery. But that's a whole nother discussion, I'm sure. One of the other pieces that really hit me that I think you'll appreciate because of, again, coincidences, similarities in our journey. My resulting catalyst to get into recovery was through Al-Anon, through a relationship. And when the relationship ended, it was with my first fiance. My mother gave me a poem. And I was really aggravated by the poem. Didn't resonate real well with me. But I kept it. And I was privileged in my Hazelden training year, because at that point, we all got to say a few words as we graduated. I read that poem with a very different understanding, thanks to my recovery that I had been engaged in, despite my resistance when I was first suggested by the clinician that I was recommended to go to when I started my training year because I needed support. And I was like, what? Why? And you have that poem as a very integral part of your story. It just shook me. It was like, wow. I mean, it is the most incredible poem. Any of that you want to share, or do you want to leave that for the book?
Leave it for the book. But that poem, so it's a poem basically about, instead of trying to get somebody else to take care of your garden, you start to take care of it yourself. I mean, that's the theme of the poem. And what's really interesting is that poem entered my life way before 12-step recovery did. I mean, that goes, you know, probably at least 10 years before even 12-step recovery came into my life. But there was something in there that spoke to me. Ugh. That was so true that I latched onto, connected to this deep, deep part of me in such a way that I've always had a special relationship with that poem. And it actually has been something we've passed around our family as we've gone through our own difficult relationships and breakups and things like that. And so I actually have it in two cross stitches in my house, one downstairs and one upstairs. But it is, I love that poem.
I do too. And I just couldn't believe it was part of your story because it is a pivotal part of mine. And I'll be forever grateful my mom shared it with me, even though at the time I didn't appreciate it. So, Georgia, what would you like to share we haven't touched on? Is there anything in particular? I mean, I'm in awe of your courage. I know how hard it is to speak your truth, to ask for help when you are in the profession of helping. I'm so grateful you did. And I'm so grateful you're choosing to share this truth with all of us, because it gives permission for so many others out there who may be behind the mask to say, you know what? The world's not going to end. If I get help, it actually might improve. But is there anything we haven't touched on that feels important to you to share?
A couple of things. One thing that I recognize, I also have a lot of power and privilege right now to share my story. Mm-hmm. I am full professor. There are no more rungs for me to climb. I don't have, you know, any other achievements that I need or are have to have. And that gives me a certain freedom to be honest and truthful. And again, if somebody had come to me, you know, even 5-6 years ago, I would not have been able to share as openly and freely as I can now. And that somebody else who can't or who doesn't, there's no need to shame them for it or to expect them to be able to live as openly as I've been able to at this point.
Right.
Because there's a lot of things that give me an advantage. I have no fear of losing my job. I have no fear of losing anyone in my family. Mm-hmm. And I have no fear of losing my license. You know, all these things, which keep a lot of people trapped.
So thank you. Absolutely. And as we say, it's everybody's journey to tell when they need to. It's nobody else's ever to tell. And that there are risks involved for people and they have to weigh those out. You were in a monitor program.
Yes.
Would the risks have been greater to be caught using in that than to tell your truth when sober?
Probably. I mean, I can look at it now and sort of recognize the bind that was happening was the very process that was meant to catch people in early return to use, to continue to get them the right support and rehabilitation methods and sort of all that other stuff. But that mechanism of all of this, these reports that had to be, is actually what kept me trapped in mine. Mm-hmm. Because I did have the fear that if I were to talk about what was really going on and what was really happening with me, mm-hmm. that my license would have been taken away. And the other important thing to talk about here is at the time that I was in HPSP was the name of the program. At the time I was in HPSP, I didn't really want to be sober.
Right.
I didn't want it. I didn't want it.
I just think of how exhausting it must have been to maintain that facade, to try and trick, to be constantly on edge and lying and worried about being caught. I mean, that's exhausting.
Yeah. I mean, we look back at it and we're just like, what an insane way to live. But that was my
norm.
That was my norm. That was my life. That was every day I lived, every day of my life. Yeah.
And that was one of the baffling things about recovery for me. When I felt calm and peace, it was almost uncomfortable. It's like, what the hell do I do with this? I'm used to chaos, man. I'm used to crazy.
There is a certain energy and excitement to chaos. Certainly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why it's so important to recognize this illness as complex and a process. And there is levels of work to be done. And I love that my sponsor shared this with me years ago, you know, when you're green, you're growing. When you're ripe, you're rotting. What do you want to be?
Mm-hmm.
I want to be green. Some days I'd rather not have to grow anymore, but I'd rather be green. But in early recovery, the stretch of growth seemed overwhelming. And thank God for the principles of one day at a time and having accountability and sponsorship and the rest of it.
Yeah. Yeah. The lesson as it was handed to me was to be alive is to grow. There is no such thing as life without growth. And when there's no growth, there's no life. And those two things are just fundamentally. And so like, sorry, kid, if you're alive, you're going to grow. Like it's just inevitable.
Yeah. And that's that gentle to yourself, that Beulah in your acronym versus in the original version. You know, it's like, it's okay. You're alive. That's a good thing. It's going to mm-hmm. be sucky some days, but you're growing. Anything else? Don't want to not give you the room to share anything.
No, I think it's just the absolute recognition of just how hard all of this work is. And as somebody who has my own addiction, has addiction in my family, has addiction in my clients, and teaches counselors on how to treat people with addiction, all of those things are hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard on every level, being an addiction. It's hard being a family member. You know, it's hard having clients with addiction. It's hard teaching students, like all of it. There's nothing about it that's not hard. And that if we can maybe appreciate that and allow that to be part of the conversation, it gives us a little bit more grace for what we need to do.
And grace for each other, wherever we are in that. Because I do think we tend to be hardest on self, which trickles down to hard on others. And I do love the word grace. My other favorite word about recovery is integrity.
Mm, oh boy. Oh yeah.
I didn't even know what that was. I didn't even know what I was lacking and how great it feels to have it. So, you know, though it is hard, undeniable, it is hard work. I think it's a hell of a lot harder to stay stuck in the disease than do the work of recovery. Thank you, Georgia, for being so fearless in sharing your story. There were so many takeaways. For this episode, what was my takeaway was a reminder of recovery being a journey of self-compassion and growth. Come back next week where I'm excited to introduce you to Casey Arriaga, author of numerous books, including his most recent, Mommy's Getting Sober, for the youngest members of our families. Casey shares great insights, and his story is one that I am excited for you to hear. I want to thank my guest for their courage and vulnerability in sharing parts of their story. Please find resources on my website, embracefamilyrecovery.com. This is Margaret Swift Thompson. Until next time, please take care of you.